just the student body here and how what funny specimens there are. They are, they're cool, they're different. They are gonna take charge of the world.
This is A New Angle, and I'm your host, Justin Angle, marketing professor at the University of Montana. This podcast is all about creativity and hustle happening in and around the great state of Montana. Thanks for tuning in. This week, we sit down with Kayla Spaller, the Missoulian's beat reporter covering the University of Montana. You know, it's interesting when I talk to people about this episode saying, hey, yeah, I got the chance to sit down with Kayla. There's no doubt about it. She's kind of a polarizing figure, at least, here on campus. People sort of always have, people who've been covered by the newspapers at various levels, always probably have some concern about how their words or actions or decisions get portrayed in the media. And it was just really interesting to sit down with Kayla and talk about kind of what's going on here at the University of Montana through her lens. Prior to being assigned to the UM beat in 2015, she covered city council and city government at a time when Missoula was going through or sort of launching its takeover of Missoula Water in that court case. So that was an interesting thing to kind of dig into and talk about sort of how she formed her sort of journalistic approach to answering the questions or figuring out what were the key questions and then finding the answers to them. And in Kayla's time at covering UM, there's been a lot of controversy. I think we would all agree that this is not, sort of the high watermark for this university. And we've had successes, certainly, but we've also had stumbles. And it's just neat to get Kayla's kind of take on that, both as a journalist and what she sees as the primary stories here, but also, I got her to kind of go on the record and answer some of the questions she's trying to get answers for, particularly with regard to enrollment and with regard to the impact of the sexual assault scandal and the John Krakauer book on the enrollment here at the University of Montana. But it wasn't all controversial. I did get Kayla to talk about what it is that makes her excited about her job, what stories she likes to write, what brings her joy in her work. So, interesting conversation. I hope you like it as much as I enjoyed having it, and we'll turn it over to Kayla Spaller. I'm here today with Kayla Spaller. Kayla, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Justin.
So, Kayla, you are currently the UM beat reporter at the Missoulian.
Correct.
Before that, you covered city council, is that right?
I covered city hall, city council, and the mayor, and transportation, and housing.
And yeah. How long have you been at the Missoulian?
Since 2006.
And was it the Great Falls Tribune before that?
That's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And a UM journalism graduate?
Mm-hmm. I got my master's in journalism here, and then went to the Missoula Independent for a year, and then the Tribune, and then the Missoulian ever since.
But you didn't grow up in Missoula or Montana, right?
Right. From Oregon and California. Okay. The West, I've been told to say.
The West.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a mythic thing called the West.
Right. That I think is maybe more palatable here than the East. I don't know. You might have a better sense of that.
Yeah. Being from the East Coast, I bounce when people say the East Coast a little bit. I think mostly because when they say East Coast, they sort of are thinking New York, Boston, Philly, the urban centers. Mm-hmm. And being from small town in New Hampshire, much smaller than Missoula, I sort of feel like mislabeled by that stereotype. But maybe that's just mm-hmm. the way people react to stereotypes in general. I'm not quite sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Particularly when they don't feel accurate. Anyway, so coming out of the West, why Missoula? Why Missoula for school?
Mm-hmm. So my sweetie and I got hitched, and we were looking for a place to land to finish school, and we looked at Missoula because he had family here, and he looked at a school in New York, and I was not prepared to head that way.
Sure.
And this is a beautiful place, and we thought it would be cool to be here temporarily while we finished school and then head to maybe Portland or Seattle. But uh-huh. You know how Missoula is.
Yeah, we're stuck.
Still
huh?
here. Yeah, right, that's on. Right.
And so a little bit of time out of town, but back here, it's got to be an interesting role, having sort of had your formative educational years here, growing up in many ways here, but now to be sort of, at least at the Missoulian, in two roles where you're covering kind of major things happening in the community that affect the lives of not only you, but people around you, close to you.
Yeah, it's been a privilege, and it's been fun to cover some significant, I think, milestones, both in local government and then here at the university as well. You and I have talked a little bit about the city's takeover of the water.
That was right at the center of your time on that beat, right?
That's right, and That was an issue for, I think, at least a year and a half, and I covered that through the trial, and then more recently on the university beat, I've covered the leadership transition here.
Yeah. You should maybe pluralize that, right? The leadership transition.
Correct. Yes. true. Right. Yeah. From permanent to interim to again the current President Bodner. Yeah.
Yeah. So thinking about your time at City Hall, let's just talk a little bit about that water case. I mean, that's an interesting, I have no background in journalism, but for you, you're on the local paper beat. You've got various constituencies trying to sort of weave their narrative in the public view. The public is probably less than fully informed on the issue. Like, I don't particularly know if it's a good thing for Missoula to own its water or not. I have this instinct that it probably is, but I've become more informed over the course of those years. Mm-hmm. But what kind of perspective did you start with when a story like that begins to unfold? What's going through your mind as you're starting to understand the story?
I think that the early announcement that the Carlyle Group was going to buy Mountain Water Company as part of a package of companies with a couple in California really surprised the community, because while the water company had been privately owned, it was owned by a family and a family man. And I think since the eminent domain case in the 1980s, when the city tried to take over, probably not a lot of the general public had given a lot of thought to ownership of the water company.
Sure,
until
sure.
This global equity firm comes to town, and that raised some I think alarm bells with some people in the community, and then of course it fired up the city.
For sure. And not just a global equity firm. I mean, the Carlyle Group comes with some baggage, at least in terms of its public perception. Sort of deep involvement with the Bush family and oil and all these other sort of things that I have no idea how true a lot of these threads are, but it's definitely a group that has been, at least by folks on the left, branded as this sort of right-wing boogeyman. Mm-hmm. Is that fairly accurate?
I think
I don't know if it's an accurate description of the Carlyle Group.
I think people raised some of those concerns a few years ago, and then I think the concern maybe ratcheted up a bit when people saw that Carlyle's lead person in Missoula had been involved in another water deal in South America through, I think, Bechtel. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right that people were nervous and agitated about that.
So as a reporter, are you nervous and agitated, or what's your kind of perspective as this story's starting to unfold? The community's up, the state, whatever, the mayor's office and the city government are starting to activate.
I'm fascinated. I'm fascinated because there are so many community issues to ask questions about, and there's also a narrative of tiny little town in Montana fighting against huge firm, the David and Goliath narrative.
Yep.
And I'm intrigued about that, and I am wondering how it's going to go down.
Sure. Now, that, actually, that kind of leads me to another question, this issue of narrative. So narrative sometimes fits the story, and sometimes it doesn't, right? Mm-hmm. So how are you kind of, as a journalist, you know, obviously you're going to follow the facts, mm-hmm. but there's also this sort of, man, the facts would, if they fit the narrative, this would be a lot better story. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, that does make sense. And I think early on when Mayor Engen talked about going to court against Carlisle to use the city's power of eminent domain to take over the water company, I think we, the public, didn't have all of the information that he had.
Okay.
So the narrative looked at the time to be that David was not going to win the fight against Goliath. Uh-huh. But in fact, as the court proceeding went along and more of the facts came to light, the city ended up winning in, I'm not going to have the right language, but sure. winning their motions or winning the small fights
yep,
that preceded yep. the actual trial. And I think that might've been surprising.
Yeah. And is the mayor's, so you're saying the mayor's office held more cards than it, you know, than the public sort of knew going into the trial? And they're probably, well, I don't know, but my assumption would be they're sort of fighting the court case, but they're also fighting the case of public opinion. Mm-hmm. And maybe, I mean, you're an outlet in that. How do you view your role? So I'm assuming that information might be trickling out or leaking to you or being presented to you through whatever means. And how do you kind of view that sort of information?
Mm-hmm.
Like if the mayor's mm-hmm. office gives you a tidbit. I'm not mm-hmm. saying they did, but if they give you some sort of a tidbit and they say, hey, you can't attribute this to us, but you know, how do you kind of view that in the context of telling a story that's true to the facts
mm-hmm.
and balanced?
Mm-hmm. I think in that case, there, as far as public perception goes, you had a lot of opportunity to kind of take the temperature, and and the city actually did take the temperature with a poll,
yeah.
too. So along the way, you could hear 12 city council people talking about this and see where they were landing, and of course you could hear the mayor's stance, which I think from early on was it's a resource necessary for life. The public should be in charge of it. And then the city ran a poll, and that showed support for public ownership. Although I think they never quite said, would you support it if it was going to cost $10 million or whatever.
Public ownership, so, didn't translate in the polling to this is going to cost you X number
exactly.
of dollars per thousand of your home or whatever, however they would tax it.
Yeah, and I don't remember either if they said, would you support this if we had to go to court for it?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some of the intricacies of polling questions and
right.
biasing the survey and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So that story runs its course. And then you move over to the University of Montana beat, what, in 2015?
Is that yeah, right? I think so. There was a little bit of overlap with the trial coverage, but I think right around mid-2015.
Yeah. And what motivated that move from the city beat to, or city government beat to University of Montana?
Mm-hmm. I had covered the city, a city hall for a long time, and I really loved that beat. And then every other year is a city election year, and I would really look forward to them to learning about the people running for the city council and seeing who was going to try to take on the mayor, who had said, you know, he always says he wants this job, he wants to keep this job. And one year, and it must have been 2015, I realized it was a city election year, and I dreaded it. So I told my bosses, I guess it's time for me. I'm not excited about this anymore, and it's time for a change. And I think coincidentally, Martin Kitston, who was covering the University of Montana and now runs Missoula Current, was ready for a change as well. And it was really awesome to see how a new person on a beat had a different eye, and how he would have questions, you know, being at council meetings that I wouldn't have. And I feel like that is probably a good thing for readers. And I might have become tone deaf to things that he then found interesting and readers would find interesting. And I hope that's the case with the university beat too.
It sort of makes me think about your own, I don't want to get too in the weeds with this, but your own sort of internal editorial process. Yes, because you bring to a story and an investigation a certain reporting perspective, background, whatever, and other people have their own collection of those things. Mm-hmm. How does that work within the editorial process when your editor, you know, interjects a different perspective or whatever to balance that kind of those differences out, perhaps?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it's one reason getting a wide perspective. That it's cool to have a diverse newsroom, and being in Montana, I don't think we're hugely ethnically diverse, but we do have with reporters and editors, you know, a gender split, and we have reporters in their 20s who are out in the world at times that the rest of us are not out in the world and seeing things that the rest of us aren't seeing, and then we have some people who are in their 60s and probably plugged into things that the rest of us aren't plugged into, and I think we use each other to fill in some of those blanks. A lot of times an editor, of course, but not necessarily. You know, I'll hit up Rob Cheney, who covers natural resources, if I have questions about, even sometimes about whether something is a story, but because he's good at asking the questions that help answer that.
Do you guys collaborate on stories? Like, you know, multiple authors on bylines and things like that? Is that within the capabilities of the Missoulian at this point?
You know, I think when we have multiple bylines on stories, it's usually because it's breaking and different people are collecting different pieces all at the same time. And I think more if we collaborate on something, it might be a project where one reporter takes the lead and then another reporter maybe takes part of the story, but not the thrust of it.
Okay. I just ask because I feel like as I read, I'm seeing more kind of multiple author bylines in the New York Times, so to speak. And maybe it's more investigative pieces, or like you said, a lot of that content, is breaking, so it requires, you know, multiple sets of eyes and ears to be kind of gathering everything that's happening.
Mm-hmm. But I think there's a lot of collaboration that happens in the reporting process too. And that is, that's one thing that I like and appreciate about the Missoulian newsroom. And the trip was this way as well, where people, in my experience, aren't protective of their sources and protective of people's cell phone numbers unless, you know, people have asked for that. If I say, hey, I need an expert who can talk about business in this particular way, and I can't think of anyone, you know, my colleagues will say, oh, call, you know, so-and-so, and here's the cell phone number. And I feel like there's a lot of that back and forth. And it was from the get-go, I remember that sense, because Michael Moore at the time was covering the Bitterroot, and I needed a phone number, and he sent me some phone numbers, including Huey Lewis's phone number. Okay. And I thought, oh, okay, this is a sharing place. This is a sharing place. That's good to know.
It's interesting, too. There's so many sort of prominent stories and films made about situations where a journalist won't divulge a source. How does that work within the walls of the organization? I mean, maybe it's case by case, but mm-hmm. like what are the protocols or rules with regard to should you share a source with a colleague, mm-hmm. even if it stays within the family, or how does that all work?
I think a lot of that is dependent on your relationship with the source and with the particular source. And then also it depends on whether that source is part of the story or just giving you a tip. And if somebody wants to be, if somebody is going to be a source but not an attributed source for a story, it might be a conversation that you have to have with your editor. And there are times when of course the editors know the identity of someone that other people in the newsroom also won't know.
Yeah. Interesting. So just to kind of complete the circle, so you move over to the UMB. You said that was exciting just because it was a change. But are there any things other than that that made it exciting? I mean, you're an alumnus. You're graduate of the journalism school. I mean, there's got to be kind of a lot of thoughts swirling around. In 2015, I mean, it's not necessarily a high watermark for the university at that point, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the exciting thing about that beat change in particular are the elements that the University of Montana has that that local government doesn't as much. And some of that is like the research, the science that's here. I love some of your scientists, like Diana Six. Does cool stuff and knows how to talk to normal people, talk to the lay person about the work she's doing.
That kind of wildlife biology crew, they're so talented at taking really complicated, esoteric, great science and translating it to language or imagery or whatever media that the lay audience can really get jazzed about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I recently had the opportunity to talk with Doug Emlin as well, and he is also great at doing that translation, and also he just oozes enthusiasm for the work he does, which is cool. So there was that piece, which was new, and then the other fun thing is the 18 to 22 year olds, mostly, is that right? The student body here, and how what funny specimens there are. They're cool. They're different. They are going to take charge of the world. They're so involved, and it's neat to get out of council hall where you have a lot of people, I don't know, 30, 40, 50, 60, and to this new generation and hear from them.
A lot more diverse informational environment on many dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So as you're approaching it, though, 2015, like I said, not a high watermark for the university. There's tons of opinions and blame to go around, and sort of, I mean, you've got to have some a priori opinions about what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that kind of influence or not influence the perspective with which you start this new beat?
Mm-hmm. I think the question, the foremost question was enrollment, and still is
very salient
to some degree.
I don't know if I'd agree that's the foremost question, but it is the variable of interest to many people.
Uh-huh. I think when I started the beat, the question was, well, why has enrollment slipped, and why is it continued to slip? And then the other piece of that is what that this came more from, I think, from other people, but what role did did or does a sex assault scandal have on enrollment? And people have widely varying opinions on that. But that that came up periodically.
Do you feel like as a journalist you've come to arrive at an answer for yourself on either of those questions?
On the enrollment slide, I think I have seen part of an answer, and the enrollment seemed to be dropping here, while enrollment seemed to be foremost, seemed to be a priority at other places. And I think that maybe here the systems just were not in place at a time that critically they needed to be in place. And so the university maybe got hammered doubly or triply as hard as it should have been.
Yeah.
I've had some people who do this say, well, it's hard, but it's also not rocket science. And the new enrollment and communications vice president has talked about
it. She just started this week.
Yeah. She talked in her public interview about, you know, looking at her dashboard and trying a lot of new things, but being able to turn the dial. So she'll probably be able to fill in all those gaps.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
The other piece. So what role do you think the sexual assault crisis and the resultant investigations in Krakauer publication, like what role do you think that played in this enrollment decline as well?
So I did ask an enrollment official at the University of Montana that question a while ago, and she told me that right after the publication of the book, they talked with people who were backing out, people who had maybe applied and been accepted but decided not to come. And their assessment at the time was that it had just a minimal impact. But because the topic still comes up, I wonder if you know, parents maybe don't want to say, but that is
right. There might be bias against revealing that as a decision driver. You know, I know it's certainly salient when I walk down an airport, for example, and you go by Hudson News or whatever it is, and just rows of that blue Missoula and the picture of Main Hall, and it's basically like in SeaTac Airport, it's right across the terminal from where you board the flight to Missoula. So I think it's got I don't have data to support this, but I think it's had a pretty big impact. Yeah.
And, you know, John Krakauer, it was so clear in the introduction that the story here is a story that happens on college campuses all over the country. And he talked too about the files that he kept on different communities that were all experiencing the same thing. And yet he chose Missoula, and then he got a little bit of heat for naming the book Missoula, which I think he said he wished he could take back. But
yeah,
there it is.
I mean, I can see all the reasons why it's an attractive choice for an author who's trying to sell a book to a national or international audience. It's unfortunate that bad stuff happened here. But it's also, I think it's a powerful sort of narrative device for telling an important story. Like if he had sort of said it at Florida State or something, and focused on the quarterback there that got into a rape scandal, a rape accusation scandal. You know, I think a lot of people would probably dismiss it and say, oh, that stuff happens at those Division I universities and it's just commonplace. You know what I mean? Like having it be the small sort of any town USA, it's a good way to tell the story.
I think you're right. And I think any town is probably an important piece of that too, because he was looking at city police, he was looking at the county attorney's office. He wasn't just looking at university and university officials. Right. He was looking at the entire system and the related web, I think.
Yeah. So transitioning to, you know, other sort of somewhat related stories. I mean, yes, you mentioned enrollment is a super salient topic. There's interest in the community. There's interest that the university is focused on it. Readers are interested in it. How do you kind of approach that story in general, declining enrollment? What is the sort of, as you're putting together like a meta narrative of this enrollment issue, what are the sort of pieces in your mind that you're trying to pull together?
I think the big question is the why, like we talked about, but then also what are the impacts, and that piece has been ongoing too, and it also informs the beat in a way because the financial impacts are pretty significant too, right?
Yeah, huge.
So that means. That means there are, you know, short stories, dailies about budget decisions, but then that also means that that some of the programs like creative writing that are part of the just fabric of the identity of the university are struggling as well, and professors worried and want to talk about that, and so it means paying attention to that as well.
How do you feel about that kind of struggle, perhaps? I don't know if struggle is the right word, but there is some sort of struggle about the core identity or the fabric of the university, as you mentioned. You sort of, you know, implicit in your answer there was, yes, the assumption that creative writing is at the heart of it. And yes, there is this sort of liberal arts tradition here. But the university is also trying to find its way. I mean, the new leadership is putting forth a new strategy, and what sort of lens do you bring to that?
Questions. I don't know about a lens, but questions.
Yeah, yeah.
And one question that I wrote about recently was what the University of Montana's identity will be in relation to the other flagship in Montana. And as the system tries to serve the state of Montana. And I think the question came up because I was looking at some of the English department at Montana State, and also heard that Ivan Doig's papers had gone to Montana State. And I thought, well, that's odd. And what does this mean? Well, and then of course, the enrollment and budget numbers are looking more and more divergent, and I wanted to know what it means for the role that the University of Montana will play in the future vis-a-vis a system with two main universities.
Right. And how is this strategy that the administration is articulating, how does it fit within the, you know, what the Office of the Commissioner of Higher Education has put out there, or the regions have put out there? Has there been any investigation of that? Like how this strategy jives sort of up the food chain, if you will?
I think that is one, that's one interesting piece that came out of that story. At least for me, was Commissioner Christian said that some of the same some of those same questions are ones that they are working to address right now and are things that he wants to see the regions talk about, and he wants to see guidance from the regents on. So I think there will be, you know, an evolution there.
Yeah. I mean, it would seem to me that, you know, I'm certainly not in that seat, nor am I anywhere near it, mm-hmm. but it would seem to me that you would want both institutions to grow at a similar rate mm-hmm. rather than having this yin and yang between the two. Mm-hmm. You know, rivalry is fine, but let's keep that on the football field or basketball court or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think, too, one point that UM people have made is that really the quest here is for quality. Mm-hmm. And that's a clear priority. And I think the question is at what point does quality suffer because enrollment is suffering, right, and therefore right. you don't have the resources to maintain quality. But I think the stated priority is what UM does. UM is going to do exceptionally well. That's been my sense of an answer from Main Hall here.
Right, but yeah, and part of that is if you try to be clear on what you're going to do well, where you're going to maintain or invest in quality, mm-hmm. with scarce resources, that means you have to disinvest in other areas, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be sort of I don't know what the right term is, but it's not an open discussion of that issue by many. And, you know, as you're kind of approaching this as a journalist, how do you, you know, there's, for lack of a better term, there's going to be sort of people that benefit from the outcomes of these strategic decisions and people that are either lose their jobs or have fewer resources. Mm-hmm. And departments that gain and departments that lose. And how do you kind of, as you're mapping out these sources and people to talk to you, how do you balance what they have to say with what's going on in their own department, profession, job, whatever? Mm-hmm. And what's going on in their discipline, both at the state level, but also at a national level?
So maybe to go back to your notion of kind of narrative and what the expected narrative is, there's on the surface maybe winners and losers, right? There's the programs that are going to have the resources and the ones that have to be cut, and then there's there's word from Main Hall, which is, you know, we just have to change the way we're doing things. We're not going to they're not forcing programs into corners, or they're not forcing programs out of existence. They're asking for people to do things differently. And so so that's kind of the surface narrative. And one opportunity that I had recently was to talk with some of the professors who teach language, because that is one program that is seeing some faculty FTE reductions, and really ask them what it means when they are taking a look at really revamping how they do their work.
Yeah.
And it was neat to hear that they've been having the conversation for at least a couple years, and the strategy for distinction kind of heightened their sense of urgency to make some changes. But the energy, at least in that department, which is at the top of the list of, you know, the losers for resources, really is, I don't know, positive.
Yeah. I didn't read that particular story. But the notion that departments are trying to innovate is a really great outcome of this. I mean, we all in higher education, you've listened to maybe some of the episodes we've done. I mean, the big theme in what we're doing here is sort of exploring ways that higher education needs to and can innovate to do what we do better in the face of changing technology, changing student body, changing market demands, et cetera. So to hear that is encouraging. I want to transition to one, you know, we've had discussions about this one particular story that you published a couple of months ago, and it's not so much to focus on this story, but I think it's a way to kind of explore something that's interesting to me, and it's how you view sources and controversial topics. And that's a story about the president's spouse, Chelsea Bodnar, being involved in this interface between UM and the Messina Group. Jim Messina, an alumnus, political operative, ran Obama's campaign, and owns a data science company now. He sort of has, in the past, he's volunteered his company services, and it was the university wasn't interested, and he has a personal relationship with Chelsea. And correct me if I'm getting these facts wrong, but you know, in the face of limited resources, Seth and his team said, yeah, let's see if these guys can help. Mm-hmm. And Chelsea was involved as a liaison, and there was some question, at least questions raised by Tom Crady, our former VP of enrollment, with regard to the level of data. I don't know if it's access, but the level of requests she was making for student identified data. Is that sort of broad outline of the story?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And university's legal counsel said unequivocally that nobody who shouldn't have had access to student records had access to student records.
Okay.
But you're right that there was concern about the push for access.
So there's concern. I'm assuming it's coming to you from Tom Crady.
Tom Crady went on the record
so
about
he's a guy that's, you know, his contract was not renewed. So as this is kind of emerging early on, before you've sort of, you know, it's not really putting pen to paper, but whatever that metaphor is for how you do your work, how are you kind of approaching this? Oh, is this a juicy story? Are people going to care about this? Or this isn't a story at all? Like, how are you kind of making judgments about the storiness of all this?
I think the first thing I probably want to know is whether this worry is crying wolf or not, and what happens if someone like you or me suddenly have access to student records? How big of a deal is that? Is that a huge problem? And is there only,
or even if I simply request, right? And somebody says no, you can't have access to that, or hey, that's an inappropriate request. Like, is that a story? Sorry, I'm kind of interjecting.
No. Right. And then is it something that just one person is an alarmist about, or is it something that would be of concern beyond that? And so there's a little bit of, you know, pre-reporting where you figure that out, and if the answer there is, well, there are strict rules about this, and the information does need to be guarded. Then okay, we can move to the next thing.
Okay, and you know, you've got this source who is bringing this to your attention, and you know, he's speaking from we can make assumptions about his perspective, being someone whose contract was not renewed. I'm not privy to that process, but. You can make assumptions that this guy might have an agenda. Is that fair to say?
And you can say he definitely he's a person who might have an axe to grind, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
you should probably have that perspective as the reporter, right?
Right. So it's important in that story to give the reader the same information that that we have.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is this person is worried about something, but this person also wanted something from the University of Montana that he didn't get, and
right.
he might be torqued about that,
mm-hmm.
and he might be, how did you put it? He might be coming to the table with
an agenda,
yeah,
perhaps. And I'm not saying that to make an accusation. Just in your view is, hey, I laid that out in my story, and it's important for readers to decide how to view that information.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, while the former enrollment vice president is the person who went on the record about that concern, it was also a concern that came to the Missoulian from other sources.
Okay.
So that also tells us that we don't have he. While he may be cranky, he's not just
sure.
a single
okay,
crank
so he
on that
out there
issue.
On an island.
Right.
Okay, I don't recall. I mean, I should have read the story before we had this. Sort of reread it before this conversation. So were there other people quoted in the?
No.
Or is this a
pre-reporting? This is helpful. This is helpful in knowing that the person who is going to kind of go out on a limb and go on the record isn't alone in the concern, and other people maybe privately expressed that.
Yeah, and how do you deal with that in the sense does that they're privately sharing concerns? That doesn't make it into the story, but it seems to maybe help determine if it becomes a publication or not. Is that kind of the way that works?
Yeah, and I think the important piece there is to know you're not in an echo chamber.
Right.
And I think that goes beyond, beyond that particular story. When I wrote this story about President Bodner's first 100 days or whatever it was. And I'm talking to people who work for him, and so they're going to say certain things on the record, but I'm also talking to a lot of people I'm not quoting, and I'm saying, okay, you know, these people are saying these things, where on the dial of 0 to 10 does this strike you?
Right.
So yes, talking to people who aren't quoted in a story does help inform like what stories land on your list and what you might say in a story without attribution too.
Yeah. Yeah, that has to be kind of tricky as a writer to make those choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's, Kayla, I mean, you've been super generous with your time, and also just, you know, I've sort of drawn you into topics that are maybe not super awesome for you to talk about. So
no,
I appreciate
it's all awesome.
Transparency.
Thank you.
And willingness to discuss. But as we close, I'd like to kind of change gears a little bit and ask you what excites you about your job. Like what, let's talk about fun stuff. Like what are the most fun stories, or what are the stories that you're like, I am on an awesome story and I want to tell it. And where's the passion?
Justin, I just got back from Glacier Park.
So I'm catching you at a good moment.
So the story, I need to revisit the story list. But I know that some of your scientists here keep doing work in
you
the field.
The stuff
and the
with animals excites you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Scott Mills has done some great stuff and is doing good work, and I want to check back in with some of those scientists and see what they might be doing this summer. I would really love to spend a day with Kathy Cole, your new vice president for enrollment and communication, although she did say at her public interview that her days start at 6:30 in the morning. So, wow. But it would be fun to see how someone in her role gets the job done.
For sure. Yeah, a key relationship for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had a chance to meet your new ASUM president and vice president a while ago.
They're a neat team.
Yeah. And I'd like to talk more with them and see what's on their mind. And then 2019 is a legislative session. Mm-hmm. So I would like to hear more how the commissioner's office is going to strategize for the university system, because it's, I feel like you could maybe say this any year, but it's an important time for
sure.
Higher ed.
And along those lines, just one final question. So what role do you think your work and more broadly the Missoulian plays in this moment we're in, both at University of Montana and in higher education? I mean, I'm bringing that up because some people bring up other towns and they say, oh, it seems like the newspaper is just a cheerleader for that institution. And I hear people say, I don't hear people saying that about the Missoulian here. Are you calling balls and strikes, or do you want this little place to grow? Like, what's the optimal relationship between the newspaper and the institution?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The university is a huge part of the community, and we've talked about so many of the different dimensions, the administration, some of the politics, but then just culturally, the students, the science, and just financially too. And I think it's our job to shed light on all of those things. All of those things with our readers. And that's, I guess, the bird's eye view. And then a successful relationship between me and sources is probably being able to run into people at the farmer's market or the grocery store and having them, not throw tomatoes at me, and maybe they'll call or email and raise questions or have criticisms, and they do, and that's fine, and we hear them out, and sometimes they have great ideas too, but at the end of the day, being able to continue a dialogue, I think, is important. And then I think if people learn more about the university, they want to be vested in their community. They're vested in the community, including the University of Montana.
For sure. That's a great way to leave it. Kayla, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Justin.
Best of luck. All right, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Lots of interesting things there. And if you have any thoughts, let me know. We want to hear from you. Reach out at anewangle@umontana.edu, or you can sort of engage with us on our social platforms, Facebook and our Instagram feed. A New Angle podcast is starting to gain some followers, so check that out. All right. On tap next week is Nick Triolo. Nick is, I don't know how to describe him other than just to call him a special soul. Nick is a graduate of our environmental studies master's program here at the University of Montana, and he is just a prolific mountain athlete, writer, author, activist, filmmaker. I mean, he's a bit of a Renaissance man, and his sort of broad objective is to figure out convincing ways to communicate about the environmental catastrophe going on this planet and to get people interested in contributing in whatever way they can. And he uses a variety of tools to tell those stories. We talk about that a lot in the podcast. Nick is a dear friend, and it was super fun to uh, get a bit of time on his calendar. You know, in these Missoula summers, planets rarely align enough for people to have the chance to sit down, and Nick was able to free up some time. I was coming in from a road trip, and he was about to leave, so the planets aligned, and we got it done. Look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks for listening to A New Angle. We really appreciate it. Remember that A New Angle was brought to you by CED, Consolidated Electrical Distributors. They're one of the largest electrical wholesale companies in the country with nearly 600 locations nationwide. CED is a privately owned business-to-business company that distributes just about every piece of equipment to keep your lights on, your energy flowing, and your lifestyle comfortable. CED is also an important employer in Missoula, and they have a keen interest in University of Montana graduates. To explore career opportunities, check out www.cedcareers.com. Moving forward, if you have any suggestions for guests, cool people doing awesome things with creativity and hustle, please let us know. And if you enjoy this podcast, there are several ways you can support it. First, rate us on iTunes. Ratings help others find the show. Second, write a review. The more reviews we get, and hopefully positive ones, the more we can grow. And third, please just tell your friends about it. In addition, you can support A New Angle financially. For information on sponsorship opportunities, please visit our website, www.business.umt.edu/anewangle. There you will also find a link to support the pod. Before we go, I'd like to thank a few people for making this project happen. First of all, Elizabeth Willey, Communications Director here at the University of Montana College of Business. I'd also like to thank recent UM graduate Michelle DeFluke and our fabulous interns Savannah Sletton and Max Gibson. And a special thanks to VTO for providing the show with music. Finally, thanks to my producer, Stefan Borsum. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, insults, whatever, please email me at anewangle@umontana.edu. Help us spread the word and be sure to use the hashtag #anewangle when you do. Thanks a lot and see you next time.